Hey. Good evening. Tuesday night Bible study on the Gospel of John. Last week we did the first part of chapter 11. Chapter 11 is the death of Lazarus and his resurrection by Jesus. So last week, you remember at the start, we mentioned that this is taking place sometime between Hanukkah and Passover. Probably closer to Passover. I would estimate myself just a few weeks prior to... Just a few weeks prior to Passover, because at the end of this chapter it says, now the Passover was near. So that makes us think that it's only a couple of weeks away. So you remember the beginning of the event here, that Jesus receives word that Lazarus is ill. So he lingers where he is, kind of ironic, stays there. Then eventually he speaks to his disciples that Lazarus has fallen asleep. They don't understand him. He says, no, he died. He gets a more plain spoken. So it's a good reference to death as sleep. Paul does that also in a lot of his writings. So then he heads there, heads to Bethany where they are, and as he is getting close, Martha comes out and has a conversation with him. All right, brings us up to about where we were, right? So I want to just go over the last couple of verses of the first half of the chapter that we covered last week. Martha said to him, I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day. So Jesus, of course, it has a double meaning there. Your brother will rise again. Jesus knows he's going to raise him from the dead, but also referring to judgment day. Martha obviously is a believer in the resurrection. Some of the Jews did and some did not believe in the resurrection. Other Sadducees and Pharisees argued about that. And then Jesus responds with these wonderful words. I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live. And everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this? She said to him, yes, Lord, I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God, who is coming into the world. Now, a couple of quick reminders of what happened there. I am, yes, that's ego I me, and Jesus refers to himself as the resurrection and the life. That's profound right there. What is the source of all life? God. Yeah. So God is the source of life, and God is the only one who can truly overcome death, i.e. resurrection. And then if you remember last week, we talked about there's two different deaths here. Whoever believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live. And then it almost seems like somebody who doesn't understand, whose mind isn't open, would say, but then Jesus says, everyone who lives in me will never die. But he just said, though you die, you live. Well, it's two deaths. And remember, John the Apostle also wrote book of Revelation, where he specifically said, if you believe in Jesus, though you're subject to the first death, you're not subject to the second death. So he's referring to physical death, and then eternal death here. And Martha makes that wonderful confession. Yes, Lord, I believe that you are the Christ, part one, the Son of God, part two, coming into the world, part three. A three-part confession. Wonderful there. All right. Yeah.
Who is coming into the world?
Yeah.
Why not who came into the world?
Yeah, good question. Is coming. So that's present tense, and it's kind of present perfect, meaning is coming and remains. So what would that be referring to? Because he's already there. He's standing right in front of her. So is coming into the world. Now we would say that's a reference to Jesus' own actions of salvation, which are coming up very soon. Now she doesn't know that. She says, Martha is probably thinking in her mind, I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God, who is coming into the world to do the work of the Messiah, the salvation of the nation of Israel. So she doesn't know what that means yet. The disciples are all confused too. What is the Messiah going to do? They don't really know. Many of them still think Jesus or the Messiah is going to be a political Messiah. So who is coming into the world? She is confessing she has not yet seen the salvation actions that Jesus will take. That's what that is. Who is coming into the world to perform the work of salvation. Does that help a little bit? Because, yes, physically he's standing there. So he already came in the flesh, but he is still coming in that he hasn't done the work of salvation yet.
In 24, I know that he will rise again at the resurrection of the last day. Where did she learn about the resurrection?
It is taught in the Old Testament. When the Pharisees and the Sadducees approach Jesus and ask him about the resurrection, you know, is there a resurrection? Jesus quotes to them, this is like one of the few cases where he sides with the Pharisees and says they're right. He quotes the Old Testament in a few places about how David talks in the future tense about those who have passed away before him, his ancestors. And so Jesus quotes the Old Testament to prove that the resurrection is true. So yes, it is taught in the Old Testament. I don't remember the specific places right now. We'd have to go back and look for it.
So I am coming into the world. Is that the same thing? Like I am married, I am baptized?
Yes, meaning it continues. So once Jesus completes the actions of salvation, those actions continue. They remain. They're durative. So they're still with us today. Jesus is coming into the world and will remain. So yes, absolutely right. Like baptism, you're not just, I was baptized, or that it happened in the past, or that it happens in the present. It continues. Your baptism continues. So yes, that's the right reference that you're using there. Yeah. Very good. Okay. Wow, we're off to a good start. Lots of questions right off the bat. I love it. Okay, continuing on. When she had said this, she went and called her sister Mary, saying in private, the teacher is here and is calling for you. Now, the commentators say the fact that Martha went out to greet Jesus and Mary didn't, we don't read anything into that. They might have just been in different places of the house. They weren't together, or Mary was looking for a little solitude, you know, that's fine. So now Martha goes back and says, yeah, he's here. Now, we don't have it recorded that Jesus actually said, go fetch Mary to Martha. But either that was said or implied, so, you know, or it might have actually been said and just not recorded. Verse 29, and when she heard it, so that's Mary, she rose quickly and went to him. Now Jesus had not yet come into the village, but was still in the place where Martha had met him. When the Jews who were with her in the house, consoling her, saw Mary rise quickly and go out, they followed her, supposing that she was going to the tomb to weep there. So now, they don't know what's going on. So, you know, in that culture you'd have mourners who would join you to help in the process of grief. We sort of have that. That's kind of what visitation at the funeral home is, right? Or some would call it a wake. People come and, you know, they're not openly crying, but they're there to console you as you approach the funeral of a loved one. Okay? So similar kind of thing. So Mary gets the word in private from Martha. She gets up and goes. And so all those who were there consoling her, that's a good word, consoling her, they follow her out. Now, one of the commentaries I read, a couple of them I was reading, one of them was said, well, why did Martha approach Mary in private? And we don't necessarily know, but there is a reason coming up. If Martha had announced publicly to all those in the house, oh, Jesus of Nazareth is here. Mary, he wants to talk to us. Come on, follow me. All of the mourners probably would have stayed put, right? They might have known of Jesus. Maybe knew who he was, they wouldn't have followed Mary. So by saying this privately from Martha to Mary, now all of these mourners are continuing wanting to comfort her, and they don't know what's going on, so they follow her out, and as a result, become witnesses to the resurrection of Lazarus. Right? Okay. A lot of particular details here. Showing again the first-hand eyewitness account from John the Apostle. I have a question for you. I actually put this in my notes, a question for a few minutes of conversation. I have not experienced this myself, and I don't know. Verse 31, saw Mary rise quickly and go out. They followed her, supposing that she was going to the tomb to weep there. Here's my question. Do you find comfort going to the cemetery?
I have to.
Yeah?
One thing, you read their name in stone and it brings back so many memories and so many emotions.
Sure. And that's fine. I'm not saying it's good or bad. I just know people who bury a loved one and they never really go back to the cemetery after that. They maybe deal with their grief in another way, or maybe they weren't as close, or who knows. And I know other people, and I have my own relatives, they go to the cemetery every year, maybe on Memorial Day or on the anniversary of the death, or maybe on their birthday. Put flowers there, just kind of linger, water the grass a little bit, whatever. So I've seen it both ways. I haven't experienced the closest death I've experienced is grandparents. And they're not even close to here. I can't visit the cemetery for them. And even if I was, I don't know. I mean, I liked my grandparents. I was close to them, but, you know, they were 90 something and passed away. So it's like, okay. That's the way things go. I wasn't, torn apart in grief. So that's why I was asking the question.
And different cultures, like Day of the Dead and the Latin cultures, where there was a big celebration, and they go to the cemetery and celebrate and dance. And when I was a child, there was a cemetery close to us that people used to go for picnics in.
Picnics at the cemetery? Park. Really?
It was very park-like.
Yeah, it is. Sure,
people would take advantage of the beautiful surroundings. There was a creek there. And
sure, okay.
There were several cemeteries around Portland that had a historical section, but then also a Russian section, and those graves were... I used to walk in the cemeteries a lot because they were a nice place to walk, and it was near my house, very park-like setting. And there were always Russian Orthodox people at graves, even sitting, and like a family even asked me to come have a cookie and a glass of whiskey or something, vodka. Family once, when I was just walking by, because they were mourning the family, and they would just go sit and drink on the grave.
Well, okay. Do they dump a shot on the grave?
Do they
say, this is for grandpa, or whatever it was? Yeah.
His favorite.
Yeah.
But it was it was much more, I think a level of comfort with death as a stage that we don't necessarily have in the United States.
Sure.
Anymore.
Yeah, right.
That, just...
All right.
They're under the ground there. We'll go and share our food with them now.
It's not right or wrong, any direction. I've seen different people mourn different ways, and, going to the cemetery may be for some and not for others. But here it specifically says, I guess they're assuming, that when you're mourning the loss of a relative, you go to the tomb, and that's where you weep. So, I don't know. Any other final thoughts or comments, and I'll keep going?
It also makes me think of the Père Lachaise Cemetery in Paris, which has a lot of very famous people buried in it, who... Like, if you're walking around the cemetery, there's always somebody sitting by Chopin, and there's always somebody sitting by Jim Morrison is buried there, the Doors singer, and his grave, like, probably 20, 30 people there all the time.
Really?
Sitting by his grave, yeah.
Wow.
It's a trip.
Are they playing his music?
Sometimes.
Yeah.
And a lot of times they're very high.
Okay, there you go. Well, that can happen in Michigan now, too.
Yeah.
Do you know how burial locations work? Because I don't think it was like what we have for cemeteries, where they were all in just one place.
Yes. Actually, I was going to bring that up a little bit, but I'll bring it up now. That's a great question. The burial rituals or practices of the Jews. They did either bury in the ground, so they would dig a hole, I don't know if it was a certain depth, and then they would, the person would be bound in linen when wrapped with spices, like they are in both cases. And then they would fill it over with dirt, and they would mound it up a little bit. And then they would usually whitewash the tomb, because you can't walk on top of it. That would be desecrating the body and the memory of the person. The other action that they would take would be to also prepare the body, wrap it in linen with spices. The whole purpose for that, by the way, is to help keep the odor down while they're in the process of burying somebody. Yes, they would bury somebody the same day. But as some of you may know, when you die, it's a matter of, I don't know, half an hour or an hour. I mean, fairly quickly, decomposition begins, although it's slow at first. But they would immediately, as quickly as they could, wrap the body in linen with spices in order to counteract that a little bit. They did not believe in embalming. That was an Egyptian thing. The Egyptians would embalm. Now, nowhere in the Bible is embalming forbidden. So today in our modern culture, funeral directors embalm. And part of the reason for that is to preserve the body for, you know, a week-ish or so until the funeral happens. And some of you have heard me maybe say, I chat with some of the funeral directors while we're driving to and from the cemetery, and there's different ways they can embalm for more lengthy or longer or shorter periods that, you know, different time consumed and different chemicals and different costs. So the Jews would not embalm, they would wrap the body in linen, and then one of the things they would do, the other burial practice, instead of burying in the ground, is they would have a cave, usually dug specifically for this purpose, so not a natural cave. They would dig a cave out, it would have a bench on one side. So the dead body would be laid on that bench, and they would roll a stone in front of it for the purpose of keeping out wild animals. And then on the one-year anniversary of the death, they would roll the stone away, go retrieve the body. By that point, all of the flesh has decomposed. All that's left is bones. They gather the bones together, discard the linen, and put the bones in an ossuary box, and then set it elsewhere in the tomb, and now the bench is available for the next family member that dies. So you would have a tomb like that for your entire clan, your family. And so you would all eventually be in ossuary boxes, bone boxes, stacked in the corner or on the other side, and then there would be a bench there where the body would be honored, but laying there, almost like asleep, waiting to decompose. Okay, does that make sense?
Well, it's even in for Jesus, when he died, they said it was a tomb that was not, never been used. So.
Correct, it was brand new. Yeah, and I think in one of the, it might be in John, I don't remember, I think we hear that it was actually, was it Nicodemus or Joseph of Arimathea? It was their own tomb. So one of them, they're both rich. See, that having a tomb, which is a shallow cave dug out of the rock, that was for more rich people, because you actually had to do some work. You know, middle class to poorer people, you would just dig a hole in the ground and bury somebody there. And yes, you mound the dirt up, whitewash it, and probably put a marker there. That's the precursor of headstones.
And dig it up again in a year?
No. When you bury the person in the ground, you don't dig it back up. It remains there. Yeah.
That was my question.
Okay. So, yes, you get a little bit of that sense here. And the fact that Lazarus is buried in a tomb, not in a grave in the ground, shows they are more well-to-do. I've already pointed that out last week, that they are more well-to-do. They're known by people in Jerusalem, a few miles away. Jesus, of course, you know that's how he was buried, in a borrowed tomb, but it was in a rich man's tomb, really, or a rich person's tomb, versus buried in the ground, which would be for more lesser people with less resources. Okay? So, yeah, that's the practice. All right. Now when Mary came, verse 32, back to this. Now when Mary came to where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet, saying to him, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." Oh, who else just said that? Remember last week?
Mm-hmm.
Martha said the exact same thing. And it does sound, I think this is, you know, kind of intentional, and John the Apostle's recording this. Yes, there's a little hint of accusation in there. Lord, if you'd been here in time, you heal all those people, we sent you word. And on the other hand, it's also a statement of fact or a statement of belief. So it's kind of a mixture of a little hint, a little tone of accusation, but also, you know you can do anything. If you had been here, this wouldn't have happened. So it's kind of that odd mix. When Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who had come with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in his spirit and greatly troubled. And he said, "Where have you laid him?" They said to him, "Lord, come and see." So now he's at the outside, just outside the village. So now they take him to wherever the tomb is. And then, yes, we have that favorite memory verse of all the confirmands. Jesus wept. Very short. Yes, shortest verse in the Bible. So the Jews said, "See how he loved him." But some of them said, "Could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man also have kept this man from dying?" There is the third accusation against Jesus, isn't it? Before I get there, I want to go back to something a little bit. Deeply moved. What does the footnote say here? Let's see. Or was indignant. Yeah, I don't like that. The word there, I didn't write it down in my notes, but I did look it up in my Greek dictionary. The word can mean anger or indignation. It can mean that. So that footnote there is actually true for the word. But it can also mean agitation or being upset. So I think that is the better translation here, and I actually like the English phrase deeply moved. Because really it's one word, although it comes out in two in English. The Jews who had come with her also weeping, he was upset in his spirit and greatly troubled. See, I think that would be a more literal translation of the Greek. But to say deeply moved, I think that's okay, actually. But I just want you to know, because that footnote, I disagree with that footnote. This does not mean indignant or anger. Jesus isn't angry. Well, he is upset. He's upset with death. He's upset with the sorrow that these people are experiencing. So I guess you could say, in that way, he's angry. But really more upset. Okay?
In thunders. Like, mutters to yourself in the spirit.
Yeah, in the spirit, right.
And then disturbed. Those are the...
Yeah.
And Abrimasato and Eteraxen.
Good. Right, you're just agreeing with me, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, all right, good. Nothing wrong with that.
Disturbed, not indignant.
Yeah, indignant or angry, I don't think is the right translation, and it's not the primary translation.
Borders on, I think, indignant borders on sin, like.
Yeah, I think it does.
I'm wrong.
Yeah, Becky.
The footnote in our Bible says, 11:33, deeply moved. The word may connote anger, revealing Jesus' irritation. Not only that death had taken his friend, but also that the mourners wept as those who had hope.
Yeah.
So that was...
If this word were to be translated as anger, it would be Jesus is angry with death. That's what I would say. But I really like the translation, deeply moved, or upset within his spirit, troubled. That really is the right translation. Now I want to move on to a different translation here, that a different word, issue, which you don't get in English. Weep. The word weep. Jesus wept. The word there is dakruo. There are two words in Greek, and I did a little research on it as I was preparing. Klio means to sob or bawl. Vocal crying. Okay? We've all heard that. Kids, usually, young kids, when they're hurt, they vocally cry. Right? The other word in the Greek is dakruo, which means to shed tears. But there's no vocal noise with it, to shed tears. The word here for wept, Jesus wept, is dakruo, so he shed tears. However, the word for up there in verse 33, Jesus saw her weeping, the word up there is klio, so that means sobbing or bawling.
Lamenting.
Lamenting. It's vocal. So So you see, there's a little bit of a difference here. Does it really matter for any of the meaning that we're going through right now? No, it doesn't. But it does give you a little sense that they're openly grieving vocally. I mean, tears and sound and crying. And Jesus is shedding tears, which is also a form of grief. Why the difference? And why is it that John records those two different words, although they both come through as the word weep in English? Although we don't really use weep anymore, do we? I don't know that that's a common word in usage. More often we would say cry. Whether it's an adult crying due to pain or grief, or a child crying due to pain or whatever, I think we more often use the word cry. And cry can be shedding a tear, or it can be vocal, you know, just sobbing. So, anyway, just wanted to bring that up. I did think it was interesting. Jesus wept. Okay? So the Jews said, "See how he loved him." By the way, remember last week we talked about, was it last week or the week before we talked about love? Is it last week? So the word here for love is phileo. So that's friendship love. Remember there's three kinds of love? So the word here is, see how he phileo him, meaning, you know, brotherly love, friendship love. And then some of them said, this is where I want to dwell for a minute. Could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man also have kept this man from dying? Wow. This is yet another accusation against Jesus. That's three times now that somebody has hinted at Martha and Mary each, and now the crowds. They each hinted at Jesus could have done something. Well, could he have done something? I think there's a lesson here for us, a practical lesson, a direct application. Could Jesus have gotten there in time and saved Lazarus from dying?
Yes.
Yes.
He didn't even need to go there to do it.
He didn't even go there to do it.
I mean, he didn't need to go
there. The disciples, no, you're right, he didn't. Yeah. He could have just spoke like he did in other miracles. He didn't. Why not? Because he had greater plans. There was something greater he had in mind. Does that happen to us? We ask for something. God, you're being sarcastic, of course. We pray to God for something. Take this pain, take this disease, or this financial issue I have, or whatever, and you feel like God's not answering. Or Jesus is staying away, or he's lingering where he is for 2 days or 4 days and not responding. Well, he's got bigger plans for you. Sometimes we just need to wait. I think that was true for me in a few cases. One that I've maybe have mentioned in the past is, as a young man coming out of college, I knew I wanted to get married and have a family. I prayed for a wife. It wasn't until 8 years later that I met Jill. And I say, God was teaching me patience because I was really impatient. He taught me patience, which I think I mostly retained that lesson. But sometimes we have to wait. Sometimes we think, and people ask me this question, Pastor, why do bad things happen? Why did this bad thing happen to me? And I say, I don't know, but God's got good plans for you in the future. You know, that's the whole Jeremiah thing. I have plans for you. And I don't know if the future means next week, next month, next year, or in the afterlife. But God has good plans for you. Okay? So, right here too. You know, kind of people lamenting, why couldn't Jesus come and have saved him from dying? Well, Jesus had better plans, bigger plans. All right. Onward. Then Jesus, deeply moved again, it's the same word as we just talked about, okay? Deeply moved again, came to the tomb. It was a cave, and a stone lay against it. Yes, I've already talked about the burial practices. I was going to bring that up there. Jesus said, "Take away the stone." Martha, the sister of the dead man, said to him, "Lord, by this time there will be an odor, for he has been dead 4 days." By the fourth day, decomposition has set in a vigorous way. Yes, the odor would have overcome the spices that were there. The spices are there for the first day or so while they're going through the preparations. And also, this kind of shows a little hint of doubt on the part of Martha, right? Jesus, what are you doing? Well, I asked you, Martha, do you believe your brother will rise again? Well, yeah, on the last day, on Judgment Day. No, we're going to roll away the stone. Something wonderful is about to happen. Oh, but there's going to be an odor. You can't do that. So, yeah, I think this is showing a little doubt part of Martha. We don't know if that's true of Mary or not, but, yeah. So, Jesus said to her, did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God? I want to remind you, we had a little discussion, again, was it last week, about the word glory? Anybody remember from last week, glory? So, in Hebrew, the word glory is kabod, which it actually comes from the word for weight. But in the Old Testament Hebrews, they have associated God's glory with his presence. Kavod, translated into Greek, is doxa, so that's glory in Greek, and doxa comes from the word doseo, which means to think rightly. Hence, glory in the New Testament era, or from the Greek language, would mean more of honor and praise, hence the doxology. Okay? I say, you put those two together. Yeah, Mark, go ahead.
I don't want to interrupt you, but
oh, all right. So I would say you put those two together. What is the glory of God? It's his presence, and it's understanding him rightly. Thinking about him rightly, who he is and who we are. He's God, we're creatures. You know, he is, his primary characteristic is love, and he loves us and does so much for us and blesses us. That's thinking of him rightly and thanking him for that. So it's those two things combined. Well, who is both of those combined? Jesus. Jesus is the presence of God, and what Jesus is about to do will reveal very clearly, unambiguously, who he is, that he is the Son of God, the Messiah. And this is the reason he has come, to overcome death. So I think right here, remember that's the whole point of the Gospel of John, is the identity of Jesus. Here it comes up again. Did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God? Glory, kavod, doxa. A very weighted term. Okay, I'm done with my little lecture. Mark, did you have something?
Yeah. Just from the words that I'm reading here, I don't see that there's any reason for Martha to even realize that Jesus was going to raise him from the dead.
She may have wondered, is he just going to go in to look at the body?
Right.
She's maybe wondering, what's going on? Yeah.
Well, that's practical Martha.
Yeah.
I'm over here doing all the work, but I'm not going to sit and, like...
Yeah, right. Practical Martha, you're right.
Yeah. Don't open that up. We cleaned
right.
It all up already.
Right. He's all bound up. Verse 41. So they took away the stone, and Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but I said this on account of the people standing around, that they may believe that you sent me. Kind of an odd prayer, isn't it? I have always thought that's an odd prayer. Well, first of all, we don't know if that was the entire prayer. There likely was more. Secondly, in preparing for this Bible study, I came to learn a little bit from the commentary. This came actually from Dr. Weinrich in the big blue one here, the big blue commentary. Jesus is actually echoing Psalm 118. Now, in the Jewish culture, when you would recite a verse from a psalm, you are basically quoting or referring to the entire psalm. Jesus does that twice on the cross. When he says, my God, why have you forsaken me, and into your hands I commit my spirit. He's quoting a psalm both of those times. Well, this time he is as well. So let's go to Psalm 118. And now I've forgotten what verse it is there, but we'll find it. Down farther. Out of my distress I called on the Lord. The Lord answered me and set me free. So answered me. Now that's the key word there that we're going to come up. It's down here again near the bottom. I thank you that you have answered me and have become my salvation. And I think there's another one down here. And the reason I'm pointing that out, answer. Because the word answer there that comes out in the ESV in this Psalm 118 is the Hebrew word very simply for hear. Hear. So honestly, I think it would be more plainly translated, you have heard me. Okay? It's a third place somewhere in the Psalm where it comes out as answered, but it's actually hear. Maybe it was at the beginning. Sorry, I'm scrolling through here real fast. I called on the Lord. Well, it's here three times, but I'll focus on verse 5. Out of my distress, I called on the Lord, and the Lord heard me and set me free. That would be a more literal translation from the Hebrew. Well, that's what Jesus says. I'm glad you heard me, Father. So, because it's three places in the psalm, this is the psalm that Jesus is referring to when he says this prayer in John chapter 11. Let's go back there. So John chapter 11. All right, scroll back down. Sorry, I'm going real fast here. Okay. Father, I thank you that you have heard me. So that's a reflection of Psalm 118. The theme of Psalm 118 is about calling out to God and he hears you. I don't know, by the way, if you remember me saying this in another Bible study. I don't think I've said it yet in this Bible study. But one of the key things that the Jews wanted was to hear from God and know God heard them. When God fell silent during the intertestamental period and there were no prophets, the Jews, the faithful Jews, were greatly troubled. Why are we not hearing from God? Where is God? He's silent. Has he disappeared? Has he abandoned us? Are we forsaken? Where is God? And they would rather hear from God that God was going to punish them for some wrongdoing than not hear at all. Silence from God was the worst thing that the Jewish people in that culture could experience. They wanted a word from God. They greatly wanted that. So Psalm 118 saying, you heard me, that is showing you're our God and we are your people. And when we cry out to you for good or for bad, you hear us, and you bless us, and you discipline us, i.e. punish us, when we do wrong. They wanted to hear that, the faithful of the Jews did. So that's a big deal. So Jesus is reflecting that here. Father, I thank you that you have heard me. And then he adds on, I know you always hear me, but I said this on account of the people standing around, that they need to believe that you sent me. What is his purpose for doing this event, this miracle? So that they may believe you sent me. It's not for some other purpose. It's for the glory of God, that you, God the Father, sent me to overcome death. That's what he's pointing to right there.
You're talking about not hearing from God and Samuel before the God called Samuel. It says how, and the word of the Lord was rare in those days. There was no frequent visions.
Yes, right.
And then he called Samuel.
Yes. Right, exactly. No frequent visions, and so that was troubling to them. Oh, yeah, Becky.
I think it's amazing that they wanted to hear from God, and yet they killed so many of his prophets.
Yeah, yes. That's why I said the faithful Jews.
Yeah.
Because the unfaithful Jews, those who were maybe more secular or didn't care about God, and they were after their own thing, yeah, they killed the prophets, because the prophets kept saying, God's going to punish you for what you're doing. Oh, I don't like hearing that. I'm going to kill you. Yeah, right. Joyce?
How do you think that people would have related to his saying, I sent this on account of his people?
Mm-hmm. It is an odd thing to say. I totally agree. So people standing around, there's people standing around now, and they hear him say this.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're like, what? What does this mean? Yeah, I totally think they'd be confused. Yeah?
This has always been a little bit of, like, a little bit of comic relief story, even though it's a very profound story. But like, pretty soon when him pops out of the tomb, I mean, as a kid, the picture of him coming out wrapped up, tied up, and then Jesus having to say, "Let him go."
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Everybody's standing around, like, it just seems like if you made a movie of this,
It's sure. funny, and so is saying, all these people standing around me who aren't listening to me, I'm saying this out loud. So, I mean, how many times as a teacher I've said, I'm saying this out loud right now, I'm thinking out loud, so that I wonder if somebody will pick up on this.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I don't have a clear answer, Joyce. I think this is an odd prayer, and I think the people right. would be a bit puzzled by it. However, it does help a little bit to understand that Jesus is referencing or referring to Psalm 118. By the way, something I just now noticed in my notes. Psalm 118 also has this verse within it. I didn't write down which verse it is, but within Psalm 118, the verse says, "Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord." So Psalm 118 is what the crowds are shouting a few weeks from now, again, 1 to 3 weeks from now, after this event is when the Passover starts. So the crowds are shouting this. So could those be the same crowds? At least partially, yes. So the crowds, some of them are here. The Jews followed Mary out, remember, the mourners. They hear Jesus. They might have recognized echoes of Psalm 118. And of course, they're then quoting that same psalm on Palm Sunday when Jesus is riding in on a donkey. So there's an interesting connection there.
I think there is too. With 118, that's the last of the Hallel, or however you pronounce
yes.
it.
Yes, Hallel,
Passover,
yes.
So this would have been familiar to them.
Yes, very it would have familiar. Been. That psalm was very familiar to them. It was a Passover psalm. You're absolutely right. And it was a psalm of deliverance, which was part of the Passover.
Right.
That's why it was
right.
used
that's
in the Passover. God delivered us in the Passover, and they're praying Psalm 118. Actually, it was 113 through 118, I think,
right.
that were the Hallel psalms, which are asking God for further deliverance. And so there's a little bit of irony, because many of them are still thinking the Christ, as Mary confessed Jesus, is going to deliver them from the Romans. But that's not why Jesus came to deliver them. He came to deliver them from death. And so he's kind of giving them a very obvious hint right here. This is why he came. Psalm 118, I came to deliver you. And the Father hears me. That is a wonderful thing. And I'm going to deliver you from death. And there it is right there. He's about to do it.
Isn't not hearing from God the absolute worst thing that you can think of?
Well, I'm a little...
Why have you forsaken me?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Right. Jesus it's, experienced that on the cross. Right.
Once read,
not hearing from God. Being forsaken.
Teresa, after all, at the end of her life, went to a priest and said... I used to feel God talking to me. I don't think she meant the words, but
mm-hmm. you can sense God's work in around you or something.
I
yeah.
feel like he's not doing that now, and she was so bothered by it.
Yeah.
Well, it negated all her work. And
yeah.
the priest told her, no, write this down,
yeah.
because this is how humanity works, and this will mean something that you felt this.
Yeah. Well, and so that ties in, I didn't know that about Mother Teresa, but yes, that ties in with the Jewish mindset. They longed to hear from God, whether good or bad, whether for blessings or punishment. They wanted to hear from God.
Dance with your Torah, Rabbi?
Yeah, right.
I mean, that's why we crave the Word.
You ask me that question, and see, for me, I can't help but think, you know, in kind of our humanity, sometimes we want silence. I'm just thinking about... Yes, those times where maybe I've had an argument with Jill, and I'm just like, I'd rather not hear from you right now. I know you don't want to hear from me either. You're mad at me, I'm mad at you. And you want silence. So it's not that attitude of, I'd rather hear from you than not. No, there are times, I'm saying this a little tongue-in-cheek, and she's not here. She's on her way back from Ann Arbor, bringing Elliot home. He finished his exams this week.
Well,
when it comes to God, we'd rather hear from God
well,
than not.
And you'd rather hear from Jill than not. You know, 3 days later,
eventually,
she's still not talking to
eventually,
you.
Eventually, yes.
You think you're
very
upset.
True. Yes, that's true.
Temporary, give me 5
eventually,
minutes.
Yes.
Different than silence, radio silence.
But we all need a little bit of silence once in a while, right?
A little bit of silence.
Yeah.
Silence can be louder than words sometimes.
It can be. Silence can be very loud. That's true. Yeah. So, no, it's just a good concept to think about. And yes, the Jews were greatly troubled about not hearing from God for a while, quite a while, 400 years. And so here, again, Jesus is saying, you've heard me, and we're about to reveal that. Okay, any other comments there before we go on? There was a lot there. Yeah, Delmar?
Where he is praying this, he's also establishing his authority to do what he's about to do. Because other miracles that he had done, they said, well, he's doing this on behalf of the devil or
things
like this. And here he's saying, hey, you can hear me pray. I'm asking God.
Yeah. It is from God the Father through me that this is being done. Yeah, that's a good point. Sure. Yeah, very good. Okay. Verse 43. When he said these things, he cried out with a loud voice, Lazarus, come out. The man who had died came out, his hands and feet bound with linen strips and his face wrapped with a cloth. Jesus said to them, unbind him and let him go. Now, just as a brief interlude here, or a bit of a field trip, I found this quite interesting. In Dr. Weinrich's commentary, at this point in his commentary with this verse, he gives a snippet of a homily from St. Athanasius from the 4th century. I find it very interesting. Now, it's a little bit long. It's that long of a paragraph. Let me read this to you. This is a homily preached by St. Athanasius that was recorded for us, and most of this, he is speaking in the voice of Christ, or what Christ is implying and saying to the dead man and to death itself, okay? So listen to this. I just think it's wonderful. It shows you why it lasted throughout the millennia that is still with us. Athanasius says, when he had said these things, he ceased speaking with his father, and turned to the body of Lazarus, which was lying without breath in it, nor movement in any limb. He called at the mouth of the tomb in his divine voice, Lazarus, come forth. Immediately the voice of Christ woke him who was slumbering, like a man who has risen, who was asleep. He said to him, come forth. Behold, I am standing by you. I am your Lord. You are the work of my hands. Why have you not known me? Because in the beginning I myself formed Adam from the earth and gave him breath. Open your mouth yourself in order that I may give you breath. Stand upon your feet and receive strength to yourself, for I am the strength of the whole creation. Stretch out your hands and I shall give them strength, for I am the straight staff. I command the foul odor to depart from you, for I am the sweet odor of the trees of paradise. Behold, the prophecy of Isaiah the prophet will be fulfilled in you, namely, I shall open your tombs and shall bring you forth. Open your mouth and speak with me. It is I who command you. Cast from you fear and know me, that I am the living God. Do not be frightened about the things which you have seen, for I have taken you out of their hands. Observe the place where you were sleeping, that it is full of pus and stinks. How have they come out of your body? Cast from you the corruption of the valley of death, as again you have seen the light, which is I, who am standing by you. Do not be disturbed about what you have seen, for they are greatly disturbed since you have received strength and entered into the world again. Be strong about your ministry. Notice the place where you are standing, that you are inside a tomb, in order that you might know that I have taken you out of the hand of death. Observe the grave clothes which cover your body in order that you might know that I have placed you in the world again and after you had become a stranger to it. Come out of the tomb. It is I who command you. I think that's a great sermon. Homily, I guess. Devotion, we would probably call it. But, so he's putting ideas or, you know, implications in what Jesus says, when Jesus simply says, Lazarus, come out. This is life itself, standing there speaking to death, saying, come forth. I call you back to life out of death. And there is Lazarus. And the way that I think of it from Lazarus' perspective, he's dead. I don't know, you know, sometimes I jokingly say, this is a humorous moment too, that he has a Homer Simpson moment where he goes, Dole, I'm back on earth. I I liked being in heaven. But we don't know. He might have just been unconscious, basically, in his own mind. We don't know. Nobody asked him. Where were you for those 4 days? What was your consciousness? Were you in heaven, or were you just kind of asleep? You know, maybe he died, and then all of a sudden, he hears Jesus' voice, and he's waking up, like Athanasius says, like a man arising out of sleep. So he's waking up, and he comes out. And yes, you know, you could say it's a little bit funny, Jen, because he's coming out like a mummy like this. All wrapped up. They would wrap them up completely in linens, and they'd have a separate piece around their head, and so he would be like bound like that. And so Jesus has a double entendre here. Unbind him and let him go. He's talking to the people around, take those grave clothes, those linens off of him, unbind him and let him go. But who else is he speaking to when he says that? He's speaking to death. Death itself, unbind him and let him go, because I am the life. I am the resurrection and the life. He just said that to Martha. I am the resurrection and the life. And now he speaks to death and says, unbind him and let him go. It's just awesome. Just awesome. This is the greatest miracle Jesus does, short of his own resurrection, which is even greater, but it matches this, but it's greater. All right.
Yeah, so that would have been absolutely terrifying to unbind him if that's what actually happened. I mean,
what do you mean, terrifying?
For the person who...
He dies. He's sick. He dies. And maybe his consciousness was just asleep. He's not in heaven. I don't know. We don't know. And then all of a sudden he hears Jesus' voice and he wakes up and he's wrapped in grave clothes inside a tomb. That would have been terrifying for Lazarus in that moment. That's what you're saying?
No, I'm saying, the grave cloth, well, something like that.
Yeah.
The grave cloths did not fall off by themselves, did they?
No.
No, so someone had
somebody had to unwrap him.
Terrifying.
Yeah.
Someone who had died, and that would have taken faith as well.
Oh, the people who are unwrapping him.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, right.
To actually do that.
Well, it would. It would be scary to the people who are unwrapping him, because in this kind of epilogue here, I'm going to point out another field trip. We're going to talk about holy versus common versus unclean. And touching a dead body makes you unclean. So yes, that would have been a little bit concerning right there. That's assaulting your attention for a few more minutes, because I'm about to get there. So verse 45. Many of the Jews, therefore, who had come with Mary, see, there it is, they came with Mary, so that the fact that Mary wasn't with Martha and all that, who had come with Mary and had seen what he did, believed in him. But some of them went to the Pharisees and told them what Jesus had done, all those little tattletales. They run to the Pharisees, you know what Jesus did, we found him, you were looking for him. Remember, he was not hiding, he had removed himself after Hanukkah, because he knew they were trying to stone him. So they found him. They go tell the Pharisees. So the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered the council and said, what are we to do? For this man performs many signs. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him, and the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation. There's again another double meaning. There's a whole bunch of them in the Gospel of John, and especially in this event. If he goes on like this, everyone will believe in him. They're saying that as a criticism. But it's really the truth, isn't it? If Jesus keeps raising people from the dead, people will believe in him. Yes. He himself is about to rise from the dead. And the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation. So right there is revealed what is the motivating factor for the chief priests and the Jews in their opposition to Jesus. What is their motivating factor?
They'll lose their position.
Their authority, their right, their wealth, their livelihood, their fame. They'll lose it all. Yes.
I mean, it's amazing to me to think that they came to him and went, we just saw Jesus raise Lazarus dead for 4 days, and they're all upset and not like astounded by that.
Yes! Right! They're upset! They're not astounded! Yes. Talk about hard-hearted. They were hard-hearted. At that point, absolutely. And then further, one of them, Caiaphas, who was high priest that year, said to them, "You know nothing at all, nor do you understand that it is better for you that one man should die for the people, not that the whole nation should perish." See, there's another one. Of course, he's saying, before the Romans come and take away our temple, our nation, our religion, because, you know, they're going to say we're causing a rebellion, it's better that we kill Jesus rather than have the Romans' wrath against us. That's what he means. Of course, the double meaning, which is absolutely the truth again, so there's the double entendre again, that it's better that Jesus die for the sins of all humanity than all of us perish eternally. Okay? So, yeah, without even knowing it, Caiaphas becomes a prophet and prophesies about what's about to happen to Jesus. Okay? One man should die for the people, not that the whole nation should perish. Absolutely. Now, Dr. Weinrich in his commentary goes on for a little while about Caiaphas being the priest. And interestingly enough, in the Old Testament, the priesthood was to be handed down father to son, Aaron to the sons of Aaron, etc., etc. By the time of the Romans, the high priests were established by the Roman government. So the Roman government declared who could be the high priest. So this is kind of like in the Middle Ages, the popes and the emperors kind of trying to jockey for position over one another. I don't know how much you know of world history or from the medieval time, but back in Luther's time, it's like, does the pope crown the emperor, or does the emperor have authority over the pope? And there was this constant struggle between those two authorities before, during, and after the time of Luther. So if you know some of that history. And that was tough. Well, here too, the Romans are like, we will let you practice your religion, you Jews. We don't think it's the right religion, because we have all these gods. But we'll let you practice your religion, but your highest authority in your religion, your high priest, he serves at our leisure, and we will, you know, depose him and replace him at will if we want. So they're placing themselves in authority over the high priest. And they did that. Actually, there was a page in here where Dr. Weinrich had listed all the high priests for about a 200-year span before and after this. And the Romans kept doing that. They would have a high priest for a couple of years and then say, okay, you're out. Then the next guy's in. And so with King Herod the Great, the one that was so awful, he would often buy authority to determine who the high priest is. So he would pay for it. So some corruption going on there.
I was going to say, read Maccabees, they talk about that a lot too, where the priest would bribe to get their position.
Yes.
Somebody else would bribe them.
Yes, the priest would bribe or pay to get their position. Yeah, right.
So were the high priests still, though, from the families that they were supposed to be coming from?
I don't know. You know, I got kind of bored with that section of the commentary, so I skipped it.
Okay.
Yeah, were the high priests still from the family or descendants of Aaron? I don't know.
To the Romans?
Yeah, I don't know.
Caiaphas
and Annas, you hear about both of them at the time of Jesus. They were related. And Annas was high priest for a while, and then Caiaphas was high priest for a while, and then it went to somebody else.
Oh, you have to take a drug test.
You have to take a drug test? What, to make sure you're descendants? DNA test?
You had to pass their criteria.
Yes, you did.
Roman litmus test.
The Roman litmus test, yes, you did. By the way, the Romans, as cruel as they were in so many ways, you know, crucifixion, the worst form of execution possible, in my opinion, and, you know, having authority over the high priest, which that wasn't right either, yet they kept peace, didn't they? So here's a little side thought that just popped into my head. Some of you have heard Pax Romana, that's the peace of Rome, that for 800 years or whatever, they prevented the world from degrading into war. They basically ruled the known world and kept peace. The only reason I mention that is because as our culture seems to be degrading more and more into non-religious, non-Christian, secular ways, we can still exist as Christians, as a church, under God's guidance and protection, even under a secular government, which our government used to be Christian. I think it's drifting away from that. It's no longer that. But we can still thrive. We can still thrive. The early Christian church thrived under the Roman government, even though they were persecuted by the Roman government. They thrived and grew. Maybe that's actually what we need. It's persecution to drive us back into strength of faith and grow the church in a weird way. You know? I don't know. Sorry, I'm just kind of, shall I say, pontificating.
Don't you think we're experiencing that in the early stages already?
Yes, I do. That's my point. Yeah.
Now with these liberals that are pushing homosexuality and that, at one point in time, people were kind of tolerant of that, but now they're really pushing it, and I think there's a segment of the population, Christians, that are pushing back now and saying, enough already.
Yeah.
You know, you will tolerate it for yourself, but now you're trying to get us to bless this. These opinions.
I just recently had a couple conversations with somebody about the Elliot Larson Act in Michigan, which our Michigan government has specifically excluded religious conscience from the act, meaning that schools and then eventually churches, they hope, it's yet to be settled in court, it's just passed, so we don't know yet, that churches, schools, starting with schools, religious schools and churches have to accommodate transsexual and gender identity issues, you know, with bathrooms and such. Okay? That other states that have passed laws in support of transgender rights have made exceptions for religious freedom. That if you're religious teaching, then you don't have to make these accommodations in the bathrooms in your facility, for instance, and there's other accommodations. Michigan is the first state to specifically exclude religious freedom. So we're going to be, as a state, we're going to be a test case as it works through the courts. So this becomes a case where we're pitting, some politicians are pitting transgender rights against religious rights. So, which trumps which? Right? Which one is better? Or which one? When they're directly opposed to each other. Which one wins, so to speak. That's what it comes down to. Alright, yeah, it's a scary world we live in, and yes, Rich, I think we're in the early stages of that type of persecution that they experienced in the early church. Absolutely. Alright, enough was said about that. That kind of dampened the mood on everything, huh? Didn't mean that. Sorry. Alright, so verses continuing on. Verses 51 to 52. He did not say this of his own accord, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the nation, and not for the nation all only, but also to gather into one the children of God who are scattered abroad. So here's another one of those explanation stories, parenthetical statements that John adds in. He does this half a dozen places in the gospel, so he's actually explaining. To us who know the story and we've read it before, we know that Caiaphas is speaking unknowingly. He's speaking as a prophet. He's talking about Jesus' death. But John explains it for us right here. And this is interesting too. In John's little explanation, this little parenthetical statement that John the Apostle makes, he also says, not for the nation only, but also to gather into one the children of God. What's that a reference to? Us Gentiles. So he's including all in this. Jesus died for all. All right. Last little bit here. How are we on time? Yeah. Don't bother looking at the clock. We're older, but we're almost done. Verse 53. So from that day on, they made plans to put him to death. So the Jewish leadership, they want to kill Jesus because he's doing these miracles and everybody's going after him and the Romans are going to punish us for it. Verse 54, Jesus therefore no longer walked openly among the Jews, but went from there to the region near the wilderness to a town called Ephraim, and there he stayed with the disciples. Now, in the commentaries, nobody knows where that particular city is, and there were a few cities or villages with that name, but it's suspected it was north of Jerusalem along the ridge line of the mountains there, north of Jerusalem by some half a dozen miles or more. So it would have been on, to the east would have been wilderness when you get over top of the mountains, and to the west of Ephraim would have been the grazing land, the mountainous area where they would graze herds, much like in Jerusalem. So it's a little bit removed from Jerusalem, not exactly sure where. And Jesus goes and retreats there yet again because he knows the Jews are after him. And then verse 55, now the Passover of the Jews was at hand. So what does that mean? How soon? Well, it means it's within, it's close enough that they're beginning preparations. Okay? So that's what it means. So that's why I say, and this is just me kind of spouting off a bit of reading, that the raising of Lazarus took place sometime around 1 to 3 weeks prior to the Passover. So it was fairly quick, soon, right before Palm Sunday. Not that far removed in time. And many went up from the country to Jerusalem before the Passover to purify themselves. They were looking for Jesus and saying to one another as they stood in the temple, "What do you think? That he will not come to the feast at all?" Now the chief priests and the Pharisees had given orders that if anyone knew where he was, he should let them know so they might arrest him. So he's got an arrest warrant out for him from the Jewish leaders. Now the last little bit that I wanted to say, and I put my notes in here, I'm going to actually make it fairly short because, you know, we're a little bit over time. Not too bad. Was they were coming up to Jerusalem before the Passover to purify themselves. You guys have heard this before, the Jews and the Bible. There are three states that you can be in, or that an object could be in, or that an animal could be. Holy, or common. Common is further subdivided into clean or unclean. So really, you can say there's three levels of spiritual state. There's unclean at the bottom, clean, and then holy. Those bottom two combined are called common, okay? In your natural state, you and I, we are clean. How do you move from clean to unclean, or how do you move from clean to holy? By being in contact with something that is unclean or holy. So for instance, what made you unclean is that if you touched a dead body, that's most directly relevant to this particular story. If you touched a dead body, you were unclean for 1 week. You had to wait a week before you could be considered clean. And there's a process, and I'll mention that in just a minute. Another thing that would make you unclean is being sick, or touching anyone who's sick, or having leprosy. Now leprosy, yes, there was an actual disease called leprosy, but they generally referred to leprosy as being any open skin disease. And that's, they kind of grouped them all together under the broader term leprosy, even though yes, it's a specific disease. Because skin diseases were known to be contagious. Now they didn't understand all of the contagion and all of that like we do in a modern medical sense. But they understood if somebody had open sores or a rash or something like that, and you go near them, you're likely to get it. So they understood that much. So those things would make you unclean. Unclean are not acceptable to God. That's not how he intended us. Death, he didn't intend death to exist. He didn't intend disease to exist. And there's other things that could make you unclean as well. So if you were unclean, how do you get back to being clean? Because you cannot enter God's presence in the temple in an unclean state. Well, to become clean again, once you were unclean, you had to wash, unusual in those days, because, you know, you had a bath once a year, whether you needed it or not. So, Jews, actually, the cleanliness next to godliness thing, it's kind of a Jewish trait. You had to wash, then you had to wait the prescribed time, so if you touched a dead body, you had to wait for a week. If you were sick, I think it was only a day or two. Then you would have to go and be inspected or okayed by the priest. It's not that he tells you, okay, take off all your clothes, I'm going to inspect you. No, but they just look and see, are you better or are you openly sick? That kind of thing. And then the fourth part of it is you'd offer a sacrifice and thanks to God. We are all unclean with our sin. So we need to be made clean. Clean and common. But then to be in God's presence. Now how do you move from clean to holy? The only way to do that, you can't do anything on your own. You have something to do to go from unclean to clean. But to go from clean to holy, you can't do that on your own. The only way to be made holy is to have something that's already holy convert you, touch you. You could simply do it by being touched. Holiness overcomes clean and uncommon, clean and unclean. Holiness overcomes. If you remember in the commissioning of Isaiah, Isaiah said, I am a man of unclean lips. And what does the angel do? With tongs, takes a coal from the altar and touches his lips. Now you are holy. Go preach the word. How are we made holy? By having something holy touch us. Where do you have something holy touch you all the time, right now? The Lord's Supper. The holiness of Jesus' body and blood makes you holy. And you can't be in God's presence unless you're holy. So that was a big deal for the priests to go inside the temple. They would have one priest every day go inside to offer the sacrifice and the bread of presence and light the candles and do the incense. And then once a year, the high priest would go even further into the Holy of Holies. And that was a really big deal because they had to go through all of these rituals so that they wouldn't die. Because there was cases in the Old Testament recorded where they went into the temple improperly without being cleaned or sanctified, and they died. So the Jews wanted to participate in the Passover in the temple. So if you had been sick, or if you had touched a dead body, which was sometimes necessary if you had a relative die, you have to prepare the body and you go through your funeral ritual, and yes, it only takes a day, but then you're unclean for the next week. So you have to go early to the Passover to be verified or okayed by the priest and to offer your first sacrifice as thank you to God for making me clean again from being unclean. Okay? So that was a big deal. Who ultimately makes us holy so that we can enter God's presence without being, I don't know, destroyed? It's Jesus. Death itself, the reason I bring this up, and this Dr. Weinreich did dwell on a little bit, and I did finish reading that little section in there. Death is the worst form of uncleanness. It is the exact opposite of what God wants. God is love. And God is life. Life comes from Him. He doesn't want death. He never intended for death. Death came about because of our sin. So sin and death, we can rightly say, are the biggest enemies of God and of humanity. And you cannot be in God's presence while being unclean or even common. You have to be sanctified. You have to be made holy. And it's Jesus who does that. He's the one who sanctifies you. And yes, He sanctifies you. He can do it in word. As you said earlier, Jen, about, you know, Jesus could just say the word from afar and Lazarus could have been healed. He wouldn't even have had to say it. He could have thought it. Exactly right. Jesus' words sanctify you, make you holy. Sanctify means make you holy. We have the blessing in the Lutheran Church of properly understanding the Lord's Supper. So now you also have the reality of Jesus' body and blood in with and under the bread and the wine, also making you holy. So you are made holy so you can stand in the presence of God without fear and without worry or doubt that you will be destroyed for your uncleanness. Okay? It's wonderful good news. It's really great. And all of that by this this little phrase that they came to the Passover to purify themselves. They went up to purify themselves. They had to go early in order to do that. Lots of other things could make you unclean. Pigs were an unclean animal, as were shellfish. So if you merely touched a pig, you were unclean. That's why the Jews did not like pork, and you know, I'm so glad we can eat bacon now. So there were lots of things. You could go back and read Leviticus, but all of Leviticus is about those categories of things, of clean and unclean, and holy, and how do you make yourself clean again when you're unclean.
So when they're wrapping dead bodies, when they're carrying the body from the cross to the tomb,
yep.
They knew that they were going to be...
That made them unclean. Now, in that particular case, there might have been an exception because it was Jesus. I don't know, but yes. From the Jewish mindset, they would have been unclean, which would have meant for next week, they would not be able to enter the temple.
Oh, just a week.
Yes.
Time alone would heal.
Time alone would heal. Now, you know, part of it is a little practical benefit, because they don't know about germs yet. So if somebody's sick, communicable diseases, you know, you have to stay away. You can't go in the temple where the crowds are, because you're going to get other people sick. So there's actually a little practical, unknown to them, a little practical reason why God has these rules to protect them. But of course, the greater reason was to impress upon them the spiritual need for us to be made clean again and ultimately be made holy so we can be in God's presence. Does that all make sense? Sort of?
It makes sense, but I don't get why people would choose to do that.
Choose to, like, be one of the people taking care of a dead body.
Yeah, or even a sick person.
Or even a sick person. Yes, it was a big deal.
Yeah.
Because you put your own, you made yourself unclean by taking care of a sick person or by taking care of a dead body. Now, it didn't last long, a week, and then you could be clean again. But yes, it meant for that next week you couldn't go to the temple. You weren't supposed to be around other people, you know, kind of have some separation from them.
Gives you a look at the Good Samaritan in another way.
Yes.
This is a contaminated person.
Yes. Contaminated. That's a good word. We are all contaminated. And yes, that also puts in light somebody who tends to the sick people or to a dead body on behalf of the family. That's quite an act of love, because you're giving up something of yourself. You're giving up your access to the temple for a week to do that.
Having a baby. Having your period.
Both of those also counted as making you unclean. That's right. Honestly, having sex. Mm-hmm. Both parties were unclean. So, that sounds strange because, you know, that's necessary for babies, of course. But, yeah, it makes you unclean. That's what it was. That's what it was. It was bodily fluids. Yeah.
Did you still go to synagogue?
That I don't know. I'd have to look at that. I'm not sure if the synagogue was included or not. I'm not sure. I tend to think it wasn't, that you could not go to synagogue. But I'd have to read a little bit and research it.
That's why women can't be out and about.
That's why she sat on the idols.
Yeah.
You could make her get off.
But right, right.
Because you couldn't go
to
church or, you know.
Any place. Yeah.
Or anywhere. Or be touching somebody who was having their period.
Yeah. Was there a hand back there, Rich?
Yeah. When Joseph requested the body from Pilate, then either he had to have someone do that for him, or at that point in time he decided that Jesus was, in fact, the Savior, because he was unclean after that.
He was.
For a week.
Yes.
So he couldn't participate in the Passover.
Well, the Passover was over at that point. The Passover was on Friday. Good Friday was the Passover. So, but yes, he could not go, and Joseph and Nicodemus both. They were, again, that's kind of an act of love. They were giving up their access to the temple for a week by being unclean. Yeah, you're right. Puts new light on somebody who's a caretaker of someone else. Someone who cares for the sick, for instance. It is an act of dedication. Yeah. All right, let's rise and close with the Lord's Prayer. Our Father, who art in heaven,
be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.
Thanks for coming. Have a good night.
Thank you, Pastor.